You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hello, I am the monster of the Monster Sci-Fi Show. You may be confused, but I am the superior version of the monster, and not just some variant. Much like me, this podcast is burdened with glorious purpose. I'm here to say this podcast delivers timely sci-fi and pop culture news plus movie and TV commentary reviews. In the end, is this not simpler? Subscribe to the Monster Sci-Fi Show. It's sci-fi. From a certain point of view, the Monster Sci-Fi Show is part of the ESO Network.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. We're going to go science fiction this week on this episode of Monster Attack, and this is a very special film from 1970. Now, it's very special not only in that I think it's a very good science fiction film and a very memorable one for me growing up, but also because it was from a time period in my life that was a little traumatic. You know, I share a lot about my growing up because it has a lot to do with what we're talking about here, a Monster Attack. Yeah, you know, we grew up monster kids, and like we were saying last week and the week before, it's a lifestyle. It wasn't just a hobby. It was a lifestyle. So around this time period, I was living in upstate New York. And, you know, was just starting high school, got really, you know, was really finding myself. You know, I was of that age, you know, when we're in our early teens, where we're trying to figure out who we are, you know, getting a circle of friends around us and that sort of thing. And it's a difficult time for anybody at that age. You know, that's why they call it a coming of age type time period. And then all of a sudden, my dad gets transferred, and because of his business, he has to go to Raleigh, North Carolina, and we pack up the family and move to Raleigh just before this movie is released. So all of a sudden, you know, I have found myself in this high school, and now I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina, in the high school that I ended up graduating from, not knowing anybody. I mean, literally anybody in the area. That summer was a very difficult one for me, before I started the 10th grade. And those early months in the 10th grade were difficult. I mean, imagine, I'm sure some of you have been through something like this. If you were, you know, a military brat, as they call them. I wasn't a military brat, but, where you had to move around a lot and that sort of thing. It could be very traumatic. Especially, you know, not knowing, when you were going to move at any particular time, where you just seem to get settled in. All of a sudden you're up and moving again. So this was a difficult time of trying to adjust not only, to an area where I knew no one. I mean, I knew no one in the neighborhood. Those first few weeks at school, I knew absolutely no one. Of course, I developed some very, very good friendships, in the 3 years that I was at that high school. And getting ready to go to a reunion here in just a few, in less than a year now, with some of those folks who have remained dear friends over these years. So some good stuff came out of this. But at the time, here I am, this little monster kid, you know, who had been accepted at the high school in upstate New York. You know, I was a soccer player. I was a monster kid. I was nibbling around with acting again. I did a little news reporting. It wasn't on the school newspaper, but we had a situation in the high school in New York, where we would report, school news for the local newspaper. So, I was doing that, and, which came in handy when I became a newspaper reporter. Later on in my life. So, I mean, I just was feeling really good about how things were going, and I had to start out all over again. And to even make it worse, the school I was now going to didn't even have a soccer team. So I was really out of luck. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where the monster kids were. I spent those first few months that summer finding out, okay, where were the monster movies? You know, what TV show had them? And I found that Channel 5 in Raleigh had Sunrise Theater. You've heard Mark and I talk quite a bit about Sunrise Theater early Saturday mornings. Now I had to get up early on Saturday morning because usually they would show their movies at 6 o'clock in the morning. And then I found a station in Greensboro that had Dr. Paul E. Bearer, so I had a horror host. And so I got set up in that, and again, that was my world there for a while until I had a chance to meet some friends. Now, what does this all have to do with the movie we're talking about this week? By the way, the movie we are talking about this week, and I've gone on and on for 5 minutes without even telling you that, is a 1970, I think, classic sci-fi film called Colossus, The Forbin Project. Why is this film so important in having to do anything with this story that I'm telling you? This movie was released in April of 1970, and at the Cardinal Theater in Raleigh, North Carolina, which still exists. It's a big two-screen theater in the North Hills area of Raleigh, North Carolina. They've remodeled that whole. It used to be like a big mall, inside mall. That has been all redone now, where everything is like outside shopping areas and restaurants and things like that. It looks pretty cool. But the theater is still there, just like I remembered it. And they were showing the Colossus, the Forbin Project. And this was during the summer of 1970. So I'd already been, I'd already gone through my sophomore year, met a few people, and found a few folks that were sort of science geeks like I was, and all that sort of thing. But there were a group of us that I remember the guys, calling me up and saying, "Hey, we're going to go see this movie at the Cardinal tonight. It's called Colossus. It's supposed to be pretty good." And it was the Forbin Project. And at the time, I didn't know anything about it. Again, remember, we didn't have internet. So I did have some magazines and things of that nature. But at this point, I was sort of cut off from the world. I hadn't really tracked down the places where I could buy monster models at. Although I did find it because I continued building monster models during these years. But at the time, I was still just trying to figure out where everything was. See, all of that I had in a set up in New York and in a nice little traditional pattern and all that stuff. So I was having to redo. It was almost like learning how to relearn how to walk again. that's what it felt like. So these guys are calling me and says, "Yeah, we're going to go see this movie. You want to come along? Because we know you're sort of into that sort of thing." And this was like the first time since I had moved to Raleigh that a group of guys sort of recognized me for my lifestyle, but for this love that I have for monsters and sci-fi. And of course, yeah, let's do it. And these guys, really weren't, they weren't real serious about it, but we all went and saw Colossus, and it was a great movie. Very believable. And as we found out, it spawned other films. I think, James Cameron said that this film was a huge influence on him. He loved the movie. And you can see a lot of the Terminator series in this movie about a supercomputer that, sort of develops its own way of thinking and takes over, or at least tries to take over the world. I mean, Colossus is just getting started. So, at the time, again, and you have to sort of put this in perspective, because I know for some generations this is going to be, that came after us, this is sort of laughable. But you got to think about the fact that what we had in the way of computers was like almost non-existent. The government had some, and Colossus was actually the name of the computer that that Great Britain had to help decipher and break the German codes. The secret espionage codes, so that I think that led to the name, because this is based on a book by D.F. Jones. He was a British writer, and also served in World War II and stuff. So, you know, that the book has sort of that kind of tone to it, and that's where he got his name for his antagonist in his book, Colossus, because of this big computer that the Great Britain had. Of course, I say big computer. You know, we have more computing power now in our phones today than they had in any of these computers that existed back then. Our phones have more computing power than the computers they used to get us to the moon in 1969, just to keep everything in perspective. So this was pretty cool stuff for us. And these guys that were at the movie with me, they were really getting into it because this was very believable stuff. Now, one thing I did not know at the time, you know, we were used to seeing science fiction films where they had, you know, like fake, you know, computers were basically boxes with flashing lights and things like that. The computer systems we see in this movie look pretty good. You know, they look pretty realistic. And that's because for the most part, they were. There was a company that felt this was going to be a great opportunity to show off their computers. So they gave the film production company almost $5 million of computer systems along with the people that ran them to use in the film. Now they had to keep the computers covered up when they weren't on camera. They didn't allow anyone to smoke around them. You know, this is back in the days where even in computers and stuff, you could smoke everywhere. Not with these computers. They were very sensitive. No coffee anywhere near there. They didn't, you know, because these were expensive machines that would take up huge rooms. And they were shooting this, which is now a museum, a science museum, located at the University of California, Berkeley. So, and in fact, I think it's still open to the public, if I'm not mistaken. At the time, it was a part of the science department where they shot this. Pretty cool looking place. So there were some fake computers that you'll see in this film, but for the most part, there were a lot of the stuff, you know, these big tape machines, because, you know, we didn't even have silicon back then. So just to give you a perspective on this, you know, we had very limited computer resources. So that's what made this so cool. And so these guys are sitting there going, this is really pretty cool. And they were getting into it. And later, these guys became very good friends of mine. And I got them into monsters and got them more into science fiction. So this is a very lengthy way of telling you why this film is so important, because it marked the time after I moved to Raleigh that I finally sort of was legitimized. You know, I finally made that connection with some of the people there. After not knowing anyone for the longest time, I had a very small circle of friends that first year in high school. But this was, you know, we were seeing this movie now sort of at the beginning of my junior year, and things were starting to fall into place. And you know, it was an incredible year because the school started playing around with having a soccer team. So I ended up playing soccer for 2 years for the high school team. So, you know, it was a banner time. A really, really good time. And it really got set off with this night that I went and saw Colossus, the Forbin Project with these guys from school. Now it probably did not have the significance to them as it did to me. And of course, I didn't talk about that with them, but, cause you know, guys don't talk about that sort of thing when you're that age, but it was, you know, as I think back on it, this was a big moment. So let's talk about Colossus. The Forbin Project. I think this is a film that's a very, very good film. And I think there's a lot of people that think that because, you know, the average rating on IMDb is 7.1 out of 10. That's a pretty good rating for a film. Now, there's some people that, you know, that will sort of make fun of this movie and that sort of thing. But it's like, again, when you put it in perspective, this is a pretty good story. And it's a very believable story. And this is coming out of a time. This is the thing I love about this movie was we talk a lot about the movies that came out of the 70s. This is right at the beginning of the 70s. And I love this time period because indie films, even though this was done by Universal, but the indie films and stuff that came out, and just the overall feeling of filmmaking during this decade was so unique. It was really a golden age of independent type thought and production. And, you know, we saw an end a lot of ways to the big studio system. So we saw some really unique films come out. And I think this one sort of exhibited that. You know, these films like this, these sci-fis, weren't taken that seriously by the studio. Now, the one thing they loved about this was the fact that $5 million worth of equipment and people were given to them to help make this film. I couldn't find any specific budget numbers on the movie. The movie looks terrific. But you can tell it's probably, as far as Universal goes, it was, you know, on the lower end, because they shot most of this on, you know, three or four locations. They kept it to a minimum. They had the control room. They had one location shoot where they're supposedly over in Europe, and I think they might have taken them over to a couple of the cast members over to Europe for that. And we'll talk about it in the storyline in a minute. And then living quarters and this complex that is actually part of this science department at UC Berkeley. It's supposed to be a complex in the Rocky Mountains, because when the film opens up, they're launching Colossus, which is this big monster computer that's going to handle all of the defensive capabilities for the United States. It's going to do all the thinking for us. Now, this is not something you have to suspend disbelief on, because we essentially had something similar at the time through NORAD. And NORAD had this big complex that was buried in the middle of a mountain. That's why they went ahead and set this story. They buried Colossus in the middle of the Rocky Mountains as well, without, you know, giving it away. And, you know, I remember thinking that the first time I saw this movie, saying, you know, they were telling everybody where it was on this big press conference. The president is on TV giving a press conference telling everybody where this thing is. And I said, you wouldn't do that. And then he comes on and says, no, we're going to be totally transparent on this, because we have made this almost impenetrable. This system is flawless. It cannot be attacked. If anybody tries to attack it, they will destroy themselves. Because, again, Cold War, very heavy during this time period. Tensions are high. We've got some diplomatic stuff going on between the United States and the Soviet Union at this time, but tensions are still pretty high. Nuclear arsenals are still increasing, and it's still part of the old mutual assured destruction approach to that. You know, the team with the most nuclear, you know, weapons, you know, keeps everybody at bay, so that, you know, nobody would be stupid enough to start a war, because they would end up just destroying each other. So, and nobody wants to do that, but nobody's going to give up their weapons, because then they would be afraid that the other one would destroy it. I mean, it was a crazy time. It really was. And again, as I've said on many occasions, many of us, even as late as 1970, figured we were probably, you know, the end of our lives would be at the, you know, during a nuclear type war. We probably wouldn't die a natural death. The things were really tense. We just accepted that. That's how it was. So, a lot of this was sort of mirroring NORAD, you know, this whole compound that they had for Colossus, where all the scientists were in the command center and stuff, all part of this Rocky Mountain complex. And it's like, yeah, we'll let you know where it is, because there's nothing you can do about it. It's the most secure place on the planet. Okay, we're going to get back to that now. So this is what we see in the very beginning of the film. By the way, folks, I will spoil everything in this movie. Everything will be spoiled in this. It's still a great movie to watch, even if it's spoiled. And you know what's coming. It's still a pretty cool movie. I'm going to tell you that. Great cast on this. And the one thing I liked about this was they wanted to cast an unknown. Joseph Sargent, who's the director of the film, very, very prolific director. Now, he's known more for his TV work. But he did a couple of films that I really like. The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3, the original, not the remake. And then, you know, the one that came out in 1974. And then another one, which you may not be that familiar with, but it was one of the early films that involved Emilio Estevez, 1983's Nightmares, which was sort of an anthology film. It had three separate stories of, you know, quote-unquote nightmares, and pretty good. I think it's a very underrated horror film. May not be one we would ever do here on Monster Attack, but if I do another podcast for more of the slasher films and more of the R-rated, really graphic type horror films, it would be definitely included on that list. But he was a very competent director, also directed some episodes of the original Star Trek, Star Trek, the original series. So Joseph Sargent, good man to have at the helm. And he does a really good job with this. He keeps things moving. This doesn't get boring. And he really keeps the storyline moving, and you get very engaged in the people that he's working with in this, with these characters. The writer is James Bridges, and you might recognize James Bridges' name. Very good writer, who this is one of his early projects, and then 9 years later he would go on to write the screenplay for the China Syndrome. So he's, you know, here he's writing one about sort of warning people about, you know, hey, you know, computers, you know, we could become too dependent on computers and they could come back and get us. And then the China Syndrome, really warning us about some of the dangers of nuclear energy if we're not careful, if we become complacent. And at the time that film came out, a lot of people thought, yeah, that's sort of an extreme. You know, it probably won't happen, but, you know, but then again, there was Chernobyl, and then there was Fukushima, Three Mile Island, and some of these others. And it was all of a sudden, it was like, yeah, maybe he wasn't too far off on that. So, you know, very good writer on this. So we've got good writing, good directing, and a terrific cast. A cast that has a lot of familiar faces in it. And again, a lot of them were TV actors, but they also had some film, you know, film resumes behind them as well. Very, very prolific actors who put together a great chemistry. But it was really important that our two stars, our male and female stars, had a great chemistry. And they were virtual unknowns. Well, basically. Eric Braeden is our leader. We talked about Eric Braeden not too long ago when we talked about Escape from the Planet of the Apes. He played the bad guy in that. And Eric Braeden, at the time, was still going by his German name. Eric Braeden is not, it was a stage name. And this was one of his first American films. And Universal said, we're not going to cast this film, the lead of this film, with a guy with a German name. So you need to change your name. It's going to be very important. I guess there were still issues surrounding World War II and things of that nature, but they just didn't want that. So I changed it to Eric Braeden, and that is the name he has kept all the way up until today. I mean, he's still acting, as we mentioned a few months ago. Just a huge, prolific actor. Of course, my generation will always remember him as the evil Nazi guy. Here's that. They wanted him to change his name. It was German. And then he ends up playing in the Rat Patrol and all that stuff. But but just a great actor. Just a terrific actor. And he is perfect for this role. Now, they had considered Charlton Heston and Gregory Peck for this part. But Sargent and Universal both, they agreed they wanted an unknown. They thought it would be better. Because then people wouldn't be able to have preconceived notions of the character. They wanted, you know, people coming in totally cold on this, because that's how the character is presented. He is Forbin, Dr. Charles Forbin. So they wanted you to, you know, not have any preconceived notions on who this guy was. And it was a smart move. I think it was a very, very smart move on their part, because it almost forces you to want to know more about this guy. And Joseph Sargent does a great job in his direction of making you want to get engaged with this guy. And his female co-star, Susan Clark. Now, I was saying, you know, Susan Clark wasn't really an unknown, but she was just coming into her own at this time. It would be right after she makes this film. Now, she was doing a lot of successful stage work, a Canadian actress. had quite a good reputation when she came down here to the United States. And she plays one of the doctors involved with the project, Dr. Cleo Markham. Now, after this, she would go on to do some terrific television work. And, some of the better made-for-TV films that were ever produced, one specifically, Babe, which she did in 1975, about Babe Diedrichson-Zaharias. And it was during the filming of that she would meet her husband and the person she'd be married to for more than 30 years, Alex Karras. And they would go on to produce and star in other films. And then, of course, they were best known for A Generation Behind Mine for Webster, which was sort of a Different Strokes type TV show that ran for several years, as well as they were played a couple who had adopted a black little boy, and some of the situation comedy situations that would surrounded that. It was a show I didn't watch a whole lot because it was a little overloaded with those kind of sitcoms, but it was very successful for ABC, and she just continued going on and doing a lot of fine work on television and on screen. And basically, she backed off of acting about 3 or 4 years ago. Not acting, but, feature film acting and television acting, and went back to the stage and started performing on stage and doing a lot of theater work in Southern California. And that's what she's doing now. So a great chemistry with her and Eric Braeden. They really play this well because they have to develop not only a professional relationship in this film, but a personal one as well. And we're going to tell you why in just a moment. Some of the other people you're going to see in this, I especially like the guy that they cast as the President of the United States, Gordon Pinsett. Gordon Pinsett is one of those guys, you don't know his name, but you will recognize him. And at the time that this film was made, I know he got cast. I'm almost certain, I can't prove it, but he looked like one of the Kennedys. And I think they wanted to put a younger, younger president in this film. And he looks like either John Kennedy or Bobby Kennedy. Actually, a little more like Bobby Kennedy, who had been shot and killed 2 years earlier while he was running for president. But it definitely, that was the idea that Joseph Sargent had, was he wanted a Kennedy-like president in there. And he plays it perfectly. I mean, he doesn't have the Boston accent, but just the whole demeanor that he has, very believable. And I think that brings an element of realism to the story as well. William Shalit, who we talked about so many times on this show, he was Patty Duke's father in the Patty Duke show. I mean, a lot of us, a whole generation of us grew up knowing him on that. He appeared on the Wild Wild West, just about every television show known to man. One of the most likable actors I think I ever saw growing up. He was just the kind of guy that it was like, I'd love to have that guy live next door to me. You know, he was that kind of a guy, just an everyman type actor and very, very likable. We lost him not too long ago. He passed away just a few years ago. And had a lengthy, lengthy career. And he plays the CIA director and does that very well because these are the kind of roles he doesn't normally get. And, I remember thinking, hey, that's Patty Duke's father. That's the guy from Wild Wild West. Because he did that guest stint on there when Artie was ill. But, like I said, we've got a great cast of characters. One of the younger actors you're going to see in this who plays one of the research scientists who are part of this project, George Stanford Brown, who was in The Rookies. That's how he really came to fame. This show here, this movie here, probably helped him get that part. It really sort of established him. It's not a big role here, but it's very memorable. And he makes quite an impression. And some of the other people you're going to see in here are Dolph Sweet, who appeared in a lot of films I remember seeing him in a lot in war movies, crime dramas, things like that. You know, he could play a cop. He could play a mobster. He could play a little bit of everything. Just a great journeyman character actor. And then one other guy, well, I mentioned two, James Hong, who plays one of the other scientists in this. James Hong, you know, shows up in everything from the 60s and the 70s. You see him in everything, all kinds of films, every genre known to man. And then Robert Cornwaith also makes an appearance in here as one of the scientists. Most of the people you're going to see in this are scientists or politicians. And, of course, Robert Cornwaith from War of the Worlds and from the thing from the thing from Another World. So a great cast. I mean, they put together a great cast, but it really centers around Eric Braeden and Susan Clark. And I want to make a mention of one more person, because I think it was so cool. When I first saw this movie, I didn't know who this was. And then when I went back and got this film on VHS and then on DVD, it was like, because there would be many years that would go by since I'd seen this film. I was like, wait a minute. There's Marion Ross. And Marion Ross has sort of a very recognizable role in this as one of the big assistants for Dr. Charles Urban. But this was done, you know, before Happy Days. Happy Days would come right after this. And of course, that's the role that she's always been identified for. Of course, Marion Ross still with us. Still with us, still going on. She's in her 90s and still going strong. So she officially announced her retirement from acting in 2018. Although she had just finished doing a film that was released last year. So she's got a 2021 credit. But as of 2018, I think she does, you know, she'll do some interviews and things like that. According to what I read, she loves doing interviews. So what a great lady. And what a far more prolific an actress than people realize. I mean, she was 45 years old when she got cast in Happy Days. And she became sort of the mentor for a lot of people. Henry Winkler said that she took him under her arm and really helped him out a lot in his career. And she did that with a lot of the cast members. So just a great lady. And it's just great now to see her in this, because it's sort of out of place with all of the years that we saw her as Mrs. C on Happy Days. So like I said, just a terrific cast. So we've got this monster computer that has been launched. You know, the president makes this big thing about how now we're safer. We're going to be safe because there's no more human element involved in making the decisions that have to be made if our country is being threatened. Again, folks, we got to think about this. You know, this is the part that when I think back on the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and even parts of the 80s before the Cold War started, you know, warming up a little bit and dying down. You're just basically talking about mutual destruction. Because, you know, we sort of knew somebody threatens the United States. If anybody launches anything, it's just going to be a mass exchange and the world is going to be totally destroyed. I mean, there's no winner or loser in this. As films like The Day After and Threads and others tried to show. But we're still at a time in 1970, and when this book was written, the book was written several years before that, that I guess, you know, people thought you could win that kind of a war. So anyway, you know, you wouldn't have a human being who might freeze and not make the right decision. The machine would make the right decision. Now, this would be a topic that not only would be dealt with in Terminator, you know, with Skynet, which was supposed to do the same thing, or in War Games, which that computer was doing the same thing. And of course, in War Games, that computer determined, hey, there's no winner. Gee, you know, there is no winner in this game when he plays the game of tic-tac-toe. So that's what we have here. And they've made it so that it's impregnable, you know. And we see, you know, in great detail in the beginning of the film how it is almost impossible to get to this computer. And then inside a mountain, it makes it, you know, it's not going to, you're not going to be able to bomb it or whatever. And it's, there are all kinds of defenses to prevent any human being from getting anywhere near it. And that would come back against us, against humans, as the story develops. Because the first thing that happens when they hook this machine up, big hoopla, hey, you know, we've got this big machine and all that stuff. And they've got the old, it's like a teletype. This brought back some memories because the first computer I ever played on was in this high school in Raleigh, North Carolina. And it was an old IBM 500. It had an old teletype system. So everything they're doing in this machine, you know, in this movie with the machine is on a teletype. You know, have to rip off the teletype, or they would have a display, an old display on top that where they could communicate with Colossus in the beginning. Very simple stuff. If any of you studied basic computer language, the computer language basic, you'll understand, because that's basically the only language we had at this time. I don't even think Fortran had been invented yet. I think that would come a couple of years later, if I'm not mistaken, and C and some of those other languages. So you're still dealing with BASIC, and you know those of you that had a computer course in high school or college will relate to that, you know, with some of the terminology that's going on here. All of a sudden, during this party, they're all partying, they're whooping it up, and all of a sudden the computer says, "Hey, attention. There's another system." Yeah, what? There's another system. And now they're sort of freaking out. And the president's like, "What do you mean there's another system? What are we talking about?" And they get with the CIA director, with Shallard's character. "What, do you know about another system?" And all that. And it turns out the Russians have another, they have a system. And it's just like the Americans. And was there a mole? Did we have a spy? Did they take some of the technology? Because again, folks, the Cold War is still pretty big, and they're having, you know, the stories about how the secrets of nuclear weapons leaked, you know, and nuclear power leaked to the Russians and all that. It just seemed like, well, you know, whenever any side came up with something, and of course they make reference to it again. Remember, we had just landed on the moon months before this film came out, and it was like, hey, we finally beat the Russians in the space race. Because up until that point, we were getting our butts kicked by the Russian space program. But we made it to the moon first. And they make reference to that. They go, "Hey, this is a race we won. We won outright." And all of a sudden, they're hearing there's another system out there. And as it turns out, there is, called Guardian. And to make a long story short, because I've been making all of my short stories very long in this episode, Colossus wants to get in touch with Guardian. They want to talk to one another. They're mutual. They're soulmates. They're both machines with the same purpose. And they realize, both sides realize, I guess they better let them do it. So they hook him up. They find a line of communication and they go ahead and let them talk to one another. And it starts out very simply with multiplication tables because again, the American computer is all English based and the Russian computer is all Russian based. And so it takes them a while to develop a commonality, and mathematics is the easiest way to do it. We would still do it today if we were trying to communicate with people who lived on other planets, because it would be the one constant that would be understandable. That's the theory. So. The computers, all of a sudden, they just start talking. They finally link up. They develop a common language and they just start going to town. Now, there's a little bit of tension, you know, between the American side and the Russian side, because I'm not sure what secrets are being given away here and there. They're getting a little squirrely about this, but they are finding out that, during this exchange that Colossus and Gardner are coming up with like a new form of mathematics. And all this, and they're just amazed at how fast this is all going. And they finally realize at this point that, when they're talking in their new language, that neither side can understand what they're talking about. And that even if they, you know, can look at the printouts, they're not going to understand it. So it's like, we got to put a stop to this. So they cut the line of communication. And immediately Colossus says, "No, put us back online. You know, connect us back up." And Forbin says, "No." He says, "No, connect this back up or action will be taken. He goes, action? What action are you talking about? What are you talking about? And all of a sudden, missiles launched. And I, believe me, I'm cutting to the chase on this. A lot happens in between. And all of a sudden, you look on the big board. You remember the big board from Dr. Strangelove? Yeah, well, they have one of those there, too, because this is a defense complex. And we see a missile launching towards the Soviet Union and one coming towards the United States. And, you know, the one in the United States is headed towards an Air Force base, and the one going to the Soviet Union is heading for a similar military target. And they are able to stop the American one just in time. I mean, the one headed toward the United States just in time. But the Russians aren't able to stop the one headed towards them in time. They can't get the communications hooked up in time, and a city is wiped out. So Forbin realizes they've got to do something, and they agree to meet in Rome, Italy. He's going to meet his counterpart, his Russian counterpart, there. But the computers catch wind of it. Susan Clark tries, her character, she tries to lie about it, but they can't outsmart this computer. It just always knows when they're not telling the truth. It's got an answer for everything. It's starting to develop a level of intelligence they didn't think would happen this soon. And what happens is that both Guardian and Colossus decide they need to do something about this. They need Forbin back. Forbin needs to come back. And a helicopter is sent and picks him up, and they shoot the Russian counterpart. And they simply, and when Forbin, you know, confronts Colossus about that, it just simply says, we decided he wasn't necessary. So we shot him. You know, just we got rid of him. And now the demands get higher and higher and higher. Now Colossus, you know, wants total control over Forbin, 24/7 monitoring with cameras. And that causes a problem because, you know, Forbin's trying to figure a way that they can come up with a way that they can disable Colossus, but they made it too good. They can't figure a way of getting in without, you know, because this machine was made so that if any attempt was made to disable it, it would be able to pick up on it. You just simply couldn't turn it off because by doing so, it's got a backup system and other backup systems that would power it back up, and then it would immediately take measures. So that's not going to work. And we have to assume the same thing's true for the Russian system. So Forbin convinces Colossus that he needs some private time. He needs private, you know, and immediately, he got a mistress? You know, he says of a sexual nature. Some of this, it's interesting, when this was broadcast on American TV, some of this conversation was cut. Sort of laugh about it now, about the sexual nature of why Forbin needed some privacy. I mean, you know, it's like, come on, people. You know, even in the, this is the wild and woolly 70s, and they couldn't allow that. But anyway, I just sort of laugh at how TV censors were back then. Susan Clark's character, Cleo, is going to pose as his mistress. And I won't go into all the details, but they have these little tete-a-tetes where Colossus turns off the cameras and the microphones so he's not invading their privacy four nights a week. And they come up with two plans. One is there is a plan that a couple of scientists want to try to overload him. They want to try to load in so much data that that it just short circuits the machine. And the other one is they want to change out the weaponry, the warheads in the missiles so that they become inert, basically. So yeah, launch all the missiles you want; they're not going to explode because without his weapons, then he's defenseless. His power is gone. That's where his power lies. Well, as it turns out, the plan to overload him, that's caught. Colossus figures it out. He has those two guys executed. And as it turns out, he also figures out about the plan to change out the warheads. Now, initially, they try to take advantage of a situation where Colossus wants to reposition all of the missiles. He wants to aim them at different targets. Forbin and the other guys in the CIA decide, hey, this is a perfect opportunity. He's expecting us to change this mechanism out in the warhead so we can do what we want to do under the guise that we're changing the targeting mechanism. But Colossus figures it out, and he ends up destroying a city, blowing up a missile complex with Shallard's character and others. And it all builds to that, to a head there. And Colossus tells Forbin, you will love me. You will do what I want to say. You will bend at the knee and what I demand. And Forbin says, never. I never will do it. And the film ends there. See, this is one of those films from the 70s that ends very realistically, because there really is no ending for this. They have created a non-winnable situation with this computer. And there's no happy Hollywood ending, because it's like, how are you going to stop it? There's no way to sabotage it, whatever. This thing always is going to be one step ahead of you. And so they end it the only way they possibly can end it, with what's Forbin going to do? He's been outsmarted by this machine of his creation. And that's how the movie ends. Now, a lot of people initially didn't like that. But as I've said, on many occasions, a lot of films from the 70s ended that way because it was more realistic. And I kiddingly say that I think it was a mandatory thing that films from the 70s had to end that way. It seemed that way, but it was just some of the ones that we liked, always seemed to. It was a style. It was a style of filmmaking. But I think in this case, if we're going to, if the filmmakers are going to be honest, it had to end that way, because there's no simple thing. Nowadays, maybe you feed it a virus or something, but according to what the scientists were saying in this film, Colossus would have figured that out as well, and probably could have outsmarted that. There was just really no way to do it. Now, there was a plan to remake this film, and as of 2010, Universal had it in the works, where Ron Howard was going to direct it, and Will Smith was going to star as Forbin. And that film and that project's been on again and off again. And I was doing some research just about an hour ago before I got on it. I wanted to see if there was any update on what's happening with that. But for the last 10 years, I've heard nothing. I've been able to find nothing, in news releases and stuff from Universal on plans to remake this. I think it'd be interesting to remake, but I'd be curious to see how they end it. If you made it contemporary with the computer technology that we have now, it would be interesting to see the direction this film would take. I don't know if they could give it the same intensity and the same drama that we see in the 1970 version. But it'd be worth a look. It'd be interesting to see. As long as it doesn't get preachy. One thing I like about this film a lot is it's not preachy. It's almost documentary style. That's something I'll tip my hat to Joseph Sargent. He almost takes that approach to it. And I think it benefits the film. So if you've not seen Colossus, the Forbin Project, I think it is a very underrated film. And it's gained a lot of fans over the years. And a lot of people have gone back and given this film another chance and really liked it. And I think it stands the test of time. And again, guys like James Cameron and stuff, it really was an inspiration for the Terminator film. And I think probably for War Games as well. This whole thing about a supercomputer, and there's been other films made about a supercomputer that takes over out of, man trying to develop a machine of convenience, gives up too much, and then oops, there's a warning for the rest of us, and we deal with that. We deal with that now. What would happen if all of our computers shut down overnight? We would go nuts. Look how people go, when there's major power blackouts. Take that a step further, not only when the power blacks out and your home computer goes out, but your phone goes out. Oh my God. People become almost suicidal. I don't mean to kid about that, but it's like everywhere you look, people are walking around just with their noses buried in the phone. So the messages that were prevalent in films like Colossus, pretty prophetic. They're pretty prophetic. 1970, Colossus, the Forbin Project. Well worth a look. I love this film, and it's fun every time I watch it. I really enjoy it every time I see it. Hey, folks, as we continue on through the holiday periods here, we want to wish you again the happiest of holidays and remind you that we are a new member of the ESO Network. Please check them out and all of the great podcasts that they have up there on esonetwork.com. All things geek. Man, if you're into some geek stuff, you're going to love the lineups they have. And of course, they must be good because they include Monster Attack. Hey, folks, have a terrific week, and we will see you next Monday.
Do you like podcasts?
Then you're going to hate Thunder Talk.
Tasteless subject matter.
Mature humor.
Contempt for our co-hosts.
Unapologetic social views.
Edgy music.
And total irreverence for the nerd junk we love.
Are all reasons why
no one.
No one.
No one should listen to Thunder Talk.
Find us on the ESO Network.
And all podcasting platforms.
Or don't.
Whatever.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.